Okay. So, as some of you may have seen from the newsletter, today's talk I'm calling What About Samadhi States? And this is based on, so samadhi state is a state of meditative concentration. So this was a question submitted by one of our Sangha members. Can you speak about samadhi? All our teachings on Zazen seem to point to it. The koans on the Blue Cliff Record refer constantly to absolute and positive samadhi, and I experience absolute samadhi most times when I sit, but we never talk about it. Why is that? Rebecca Lee, so this is the author of a book that we studied called Silent Illumination, talking about the Chan or Zen form of meditation. Rebecca Lee talks about blissing out as not the practice. And though when in samadhi, I feel like I'm experiencing every moment with clarity and not fogginess, and experiencing my thoughts and emotions fully, it is definitely blissful. For me, samadhi clicks in suddenly after I have been sitting and feeling my body and emotions and thoughts for some time, sometimes painful or anxious thoughts, but not following the train of thought. I wonder if I am missing something or if others are. I feel like most others aren't experiencing what I am or not talking about it. I feel like I have to be careful not to discuss it, and then I feel like I am hiding something. So what this person is describing, I mean, we can't see into each other's minds, but it sounds like real samadhi to me, although we can get trapped anywhere and get attached to states. So I thought I would read the definition of samadhi from this Shambhala Dictionary of Buddhism and Zen. So samadhi, they say, literally to establish or make firm, collectedness of the mind on a single object through gradual calming of mental activity. And that's really more about the how than the state itself, which I will get into later. Samadhi is a non-dualistic state of consciousness in which the consciousness of the experiencing subject becomes one with the experienced object. There is only experiential content. This state of consciousness is often referred to as one-pointedness of mind. This expression, however, is misleading because it calls up the image of concentration on one point on which the mind is directed. However, samadhi is neither a straining concentration on one point, nor is the mind directed from here, the subject, to there, an object, which would be a dualistic mode of experience. The ability to attain the state of samadhi is a precondition for absorption or jhana, which I will be talking about. So those are states, levels of meditative concentration. So from the Zen point of view, we would call this non-dual awareness, what using language that I often use would be like dropping our mental map, that we've created this mental map of reality, like who I am and you are and how the world fits and what time is and all of this. And that's, we're not really experiencing things directly. Not that, and I don't mean to imply that we can achieve some state where we can experiencing some kind of absolute truth with a capital T that somehow is verifiable and is completely independent of the fact that we're human beings with brains and eyeballs and all of this, right? We experience things in the world in a particular way. It's not like we ever step outside being a human being. What we're doing is we're being a human being without all that conceptual filter stuff. So we're dropping that sense of I versus object. It's not like we're, going into some supernatural state where there's suddenly there's no difference between me and everything else. It's like, no, we're just experiencing reality without this idea that we are separate from everything else. So when we drop our mental map, letting our sense of self melt away, we have a sense of boundarylessness. And it is in when we are like that, we can perceive emptiness. We can perceive reality with a capital R, or glimpses of it, pieces of it. Emptiness, non-separation, suchness, Buddha nature. So all of our Dharma ancestors are clear about this, that the aspects of reality we are wanting to awaken to for the sake of self and other are not something that we can just think our way to. We can just read about it and, understand it intellectually. We have to actually drop that mental map in order to experience it for ourselves. So samadhi is, the name for a state when, and it can be ephemeral, it can last longer, it can be kind of momentary, where we have that sense of non-dual awareness, awareness not as covered over by our filters. So I'm going to discuss samadhi today, and notably, I'm talking about this state, which in some ways I don't even want to call it a state, right? Because then we conceptualize it and we wonder, like, did I have 2 minutes of samadhi today? Is that really samadhi? Like, we want to concretize it. But let's talk about a state as opposed to the method of getting there. So there's more than one way to get there. And I'm going to be delving back into some of the words of the Buddha, where the method of getting there is very different than what we use in Zen. So the Buddha, I always like when I'm investigating questions like this, I like to go back. All right. So what did the Buddha say? Go back to the Pali Canon, go to the Access to Insight website. So we've studied the Eightfold Path before. And we have, right view, right intention, right action, right speech, right livelihood, right mindfulness, right effort. And then we usually say right concentration. This is sama samadhi. So samadhi is, so appropriate samadhi is one of the aspects of the Eightfold Path. So through this factor, by this means, one enters deeper and deeper meditative states or jhana. So jhana in Pali, dhyana in Sanskrit, and then chan in Chinese, and then zen in Japanese. So this is a very interesting question because we are, this person who wrote this question said, well, why don't we ever talk about samadhi? And it's like, supposedly we are the samadhi school. We are the jhana school. So the Buddha says this, and what monks is right concentration or sama samadhi? This is the case where a monk, I mean, we can just put in practitioner, it doesn't have to be a monk quite withdrawn from sensuality, withdrawn from unskillful mental qualities, enters and remains in the first jhana, which is characterized by rapture and pleasure born from withdrawal, accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. And then, with the stilling of directed thoughts and evaluations, he enters and remains in the second jhana. Rapture and pleasure born of concentration, unification of awareness free from directed thought and evaluation, internal assurance. Then, with the fading of rapture, She remains equanimous, mindful, and alert, and senses pleasure with the body. She enters and remains in the third jhana, of which the noble ones declare, equanimous and mindful, she has a pleasant abiding. With abandoning of pleasure and pain, as with the earlier disappearance of elation and distress, she enters and remains in the fourth jhana, purity of equanimity and mindfulness, neither pleasure nor pain. This, monks, is called right concentration. And then elsewhere, he says, this is called renunciation pleasure, seclusion pleasure, calm pleasure, self-awakening pleasure. And of this pleasure, I say that it is to be cultivated, to be developed, to be pursued, that it is not to be feared. Some monks had brought up, like, well, if meditation is pleasurable, then maybe that's something we shouldn't be doing. It's like, no, that kind of pleasure is okay. So the Shambhala dictionary about dhyana. So I don't, it's a subtle philosophical thing. Do you need samadhi to get jhana, and jhana is samadhi? I can't really tell you. So jhana is meditation or absorption. In general, any absorbed state of mind brought about through concentration or samadhi. So concentration is the factor, and this is the meditative state, I guess. Such a state is reached through, and this is where we get into the how, which isn't necessarily applied for us. Such a state is reached through the entire attention dwelling uninterruptedly on a physical or mental object of meditation. In this way, the mind passes through various stages in which the currents of the passions gradually fade away. The first absorption stage is characterized by the relinquishing of desires and unwholesome factors. Second, by coming to rest of conceptualization and discursive thought, the attainment of inner calm, and joyful interest and well-being. In the third stage, joy disappears, replaced by equanimity. One is alert, aware, and feels well-being. In the fourth stage, only equanimity and wakefulness are present. And then, as a note, in Chinese Buddhism, the notion of jhana has a much broader application and includes all kinds of meditative applications or meditative practices. So it's important to note that these meditative states, which this is not how we don't describe them this way in Zen generally. I'm not been trained in them, so I can't say talk about them except that I'm reading about these descriptions. It's not that they don't have correlation to my meditative experience, but we're just more like, we're more organic. Zen is a little more like jazz. It's kind of like, it's the idea is that it's all there, but we're just not going to analyze it and name it so much. But these meditative states, although pleasant, are not ends in themselves. With the stillness and clarity of mind, you watch the arising and passing away of all things. You become disenchanted with the five skandhas and all problematic attachments. You discern the truth of dukkha. This arises, then that happens. So it's like we only seek, I mean, I guess we would seek them because they're pleasant, but the main point of them is that they allow us to discern what is true. So the path of meditation in original Buddhism and in other forms of Buddhism is a very deliberate process. So in like Theravadin Buddhism, and I'm not that familiar with other forms, but it's often a very deliberate process. It's like, we're going to take you through these stages, and here's an exercise aimed at, getting you to the first jhana, and here's things that you should contemplate when you're in this state. So here's a little bit from an essay by Tanisiro Bhikkhu talking about how those aspects of the Eightfold Path, the right or appropriate mindfulness and right or appropriate samadhi, work together and are in your meditation. And I think this is this is just very interesting in that it to me it illustrates why meditation is important for developing our insight and awakening. So he says the factors of pleasure, ease, and sometimes even rapture that arise when the mind really settles down help you stay comfortably in the present moment with a low center of gravity. Once the mind is firmly settled there, you have something to look at for a long period of time so that you can see what it's made up of. In the typical unbalanced state of mind, things are appearing and disappearing too fast for you to notice them clearly. But as the Buddha notes, when you get really skilled at jhana, you can step back a bit and really see what you've got. You can see, say, when there's an element of attachment, where there's an element of stress, or even where there's inconstancy within your balanced state. Another advantage to this mindful, concentrated state is that you feel more and more at home in it. You begin to realize that it's possible to have happiness and pleasure in life without depending on things outside of yourself, people, relationships, approval from others, or any of the issues that come from being part of the world. This realization helps pry loose your attachments to things outside. Still, another reason why solid concentration is necessary for insight is that when discernment comes to the mind, the basic lesson it will teach you is that you've been stupid. You've held on to things, even though deep down inside you should have known better. Now try telling that to people when they're hungry and tired. They'll come right back with, "You're stupid too." And that's the end of the discussion. Nothing gets accomplished. But if you talk to someone who has had a full meal and feels rested, you can broach all kinds of topics without risking a fight. It's the same with the mind. When it has been well fed with the rapture and ease coming from concentration, it's ready to learn. It can accept your criticisms without feeling threatened or abused. You begin to see the mind as just a flux of causes with their effects coming back at you. Your ideas are part of this flux of cause and effect, your emotions, your sense of who you are. This insight begins to loosen your attachments to the whole process. What finally happens is that the mind reaches a third level of mindfulness practice, where the mind comes to the state of perfect equilibrium, where you've developed this state of concentration, this state of equilibrium, to the point you don't have to put anything more into it. You have to get to that point where you're not really contributing anything more to the present moment. You unravel your participation in it. That's when things open up in the mind. Only when you've really understood and mastered these currents, the currents of craving that cause suffering and stress, and the currents of mindfulness and concentration that form the path, can you let them go and find freedom from them. So this, everybody here today might have a different response to these kinds of descriptions. I think mine, which I've gotten over long ago, but certainly at one point would just be kind of like, I want that. I want that. Tell me how I can get it. Tell me how I can do that. And feeling frustrated because I felt like I didn't have the ability to just like sit down and make that happen. Like, Sasan's kind of hit or miss. I want to be able to sit down and just like, all right, now I'm going to concentrate. I'm going to achieve this level of focus. So these kinds of descriptions can make it seem like it's perhaps easier than it is, or cleaner, simpler than it actually is. And I think that's probably true, even if you were studying Theravada Buddhism with the Nisara Bhikkhu, it's probably still the same. But how do we, so, and I should just note also that I'm going to make a distinction between, like, okay, this is how the Buddha approached it, or how Theravada Buddhists would approach it. Here's Zen. And it's not really that simple or clean, right? Like, any individual lineage or a teacher might make different choices. In fact, when I go out to Great Bao Zen Monastery, Chozen frequently talks about the Pali Canon. And she loves to lead people through meditation, and she really wants to, help people learn how to, like, focus the mind and concentrate. And so really, like, she's all over this stuff. Even though to me, I'm like, that's not Zen. I don't want to hear that stuff, right? I just want to hear somebody saying, like, be here now. Like, let go, be here now. So, it's not that simple. But so how do we hold all of this? So Chan ended up treating meditation differently, starting in China and then passed to Japan. And I'm not a scholar. I'm sure there was an evolution and it's complicated. I'm mostly familiar with Dogen Zen, which is the result of hundreds of years of Chan evolution and then a transplantation from China to Japan. But in general, when you look at the Chan teachings and writings, they didn't emphasize this constant conscious directed practice of meditation in the same way, identifying levels and leading students carefully through exercises meant to bring you to particular jhana states or insights. The Chan teachings generally just point toward what it is we're trying to awaken to, and not analyzing the how-to of the path or breaking it down in incremental stages of insight. So here's Chan Master Hongzhi, roam and play in samadhi. Empty and desireless, cold and thin, simple and genuine. This is how to strike down and fold up the remaining habits of many lives. When the stains from old habits are exhausted, the original light appears, blazing through your skull, not admitting any other matters. Vast and spacious, like sky and water merging during autumn, like snow and moon having the same color. This field is without boundary, beyond direction, magnificently one entity without edge or seam. Further, when you turn within and drop off everything completely, realization occurs. Right at the time of entirely dropping off, deliberation and discussion are 1,000 or 10,000 miles away. Since no principle is discernible, still no principle is discernible. So what could there be to point to or explain? People with the bottom of the bucket fallen out, people who have awaken, immediately find total trust. So we are told to simply realize mutual response and explore mutual response, then turn around and enter the world. Roam and play in samadhi. Every detail clearly appears before you. Sound and form, echo and shadow happen instantly without leaving traces. Jazz or poetry, maybe poetry, like,
Oh, Domiel,
yeah.
are you willing to take questions now or do you want to wait?
I have quite a lot to cover. Can it wait?
Well, I don't know. It's Maria. She's
Hi,
her
Maria.
hand up for quite a while.
Is it quick? Yeah.
Let
Go
her
ahead.
answer that.
Go ahead and speak up later. Okay, so well, another thing that emerged in Chinese Chan was this idea of sudden awakening. There's a lot of debate about what that really means, right? But the idea There's more of an emphasis on, okay, reality with a capital R is right in front of you. Nothing is actually obscuring your experience of it, except your own mind. So, in theory, it could just be like that. Now, in practice, we're all very caught up in our views and our delusions. But like essentially the Chan practices ended up just being they dunk you in like a stew of practice that was meant to just be working on you in all different kinds of ways. Precept practice, textual study, interaction with the teacher and the Sangha. If you were a monk, I mean, which is, what most of the practice was for so many centuries, you'd have this 24/7 schedule you were following. You would have practice roles. You would have, like, it's like a, yeah, it's like you're dumped in this stew of practice, not just off you go, and this is all about meditation, and you're going to sit in meditation and meditate really hard and attain these states and insights. That's kind of like that's divorced from this broader container of practice. So the idea was that you just like stew in there for a while, and then you never know. You can hear a rock hitting a piece of bamboo, and the sound will just make you go, oh, right? So that was more of the emphasis. And yet, of course, we must do something. So this gets very briefly to this, is it a letting go versus directed effort approach? So there's nothing wrong with directed effort approaches to meditation. As I've talked about, I have stuff on my podcast about it. But our shikantaza, our silent illumination practice, is one of letting go. That essentially we have everything we need. We don't have to like remake ourselves over the course of lifetimes. That is right here, and we just need to. It's like we're holding a bowl of water that's very turbid from all of the activity, that all the agitation. And we're just trying to let the water become still, let all that turbidity settle out, and then we can see clearly to the bottom. These methods get us to the same place. I'm not saying they get us there every time we sit down. Well, there may be a few people who get there every time they sit down. For many of us, for me, I guess I have a little more access to it after 30 years of practice, but that's not saying a whole lot. Most of the time it's, in retreat where I really I've put everything in my life aside, and I have some time in stillness, and I've my brain burns through its bullshit for a few days. Right? Then there is some of this stillness. And I believe wholeheartedly in our letting go approach to this. I went to a meditation retreat out at Great Vow, and the leader of the retreat was focusing on concentration. He was like, we are going to work on concentration. We put little stickies on the floor in front of us, and we concentrated on the sticky note. And that wasn't the only thing we did, but we'd like was concentration practice. And I was just out there because that retreat worked with my schedule. And I was a Zen teacher, so I figured I'm going to just do whatever I want. Like, I put the little sticky on the floor, but I didn't concentrate at all. Like, the entire, I just, not one moment of one meditation period. I just did shikantaza. I just let go, kept on trying to show up, open my awareness to whatever was. And I was like, it was so gratifying over the course of the week when my samadhi developed. It's like there are two paths to the same place. I kind of think of it as like, you could try to be like boiling the pool of water down, or you could just let it evaporate. So in a way, I feel it's concentrated, to continue with that metaphor, because so much has evaporated, right? It gets down to what is simple. So that leaves us with like, okay, yes, even in our practice, are we aiming for samadhi? That's what we're trying to get over the course of our retreat. It's difficult. It's difficult not to try. I mean, whether you think that you have ever experienced it before or not, if you haven't, then you're like, I really want to experience it. And if you have, you're like, I got to get that again. So it's very difficult not to try. But for the most part, I love the image that my teacher Kyogen said. It's like we are creating the conditions for samadhi, like you create a lap for a cat who's very, very shy and standoffish cat, right? So we are just going to be very still and inviting, and sometimes that cat will come and curl up, and if you like, yes, and you grab it, then it's going to run away, right? So it's a fine art. Like, so how do we create these conditions and yet be very not see it as something we are doing, which is this is the it, our approach of letting go can be very frustrating in that it can be vague. Like, I don't know, what am I doing? What am I doing? What am I supposed to do? It's hard to grasp the effort, to make the right effort, to be alert. But if you use the other approach, then the trap is when you do achieve samadhi, it is something you are achieving, and there's so you impede the whole process of that kind of non-dual awareness. Whereas when we have this sense of like Tanisaro was saying, like you unravel your participation in it. So in a sense, that is where we are starting, is trying to unravel our participation in it, so that when we recognize it, it's an incredibly natural state, right? It's not a special high energy transcendent thing that we are achieving and maintaining. It's like an absence, right? It's an absence of bullshit. Just a spacious absence of anything extra. So that samadhi is what allows us to see clearly. And yet, if we concretize it, it can just make us miserable trying to chase it or compare ourselves with others. I think what is helpful is I guess I can speak from my personal experience that if the rewards of this practice depended on your ability to achieve and lasting samadhi states, achieve remarkably clear, still lasting samadhi states, then I would not be sitting here. I have friends and peers for whom samadhi has not been a problem. I mean, I don't know. Some people get the instructions for Zazen. The first thing they are told is to count their breaths, exhalations 1 to 10. And then if they lose track, start back at one. Or if they get to 10, start back at one. And I know I have a friend who is just like, and then what? I mean, like that was just no problem for her at all. I just think our mind, like all of us are so different. I think we go from a continuum all the way from like extreme ADD to like sit down and you got samadhi. I mean, we're all somewhere along that spectrum in terms of just how much natural activity and energy there is in our brain. And that doesn't, I don't, maybe if you could, you have easier access to samadhi, you get more insights, but I can tell you, I have watched these folks who do have more of this access, and I do not see anything miraculous happening there. It does not seem like overnight they're like, oh yes. I mean, it seems to take just as long. Maybe they get insights, but then they can't integrate them as well into their lives. I mean, our practice is holistic. It has so many different aspects. It's not just, gaining an insight. So in a way, I feel like it all kind of comes out in the wash, and you don't really, it doesn't depend on that. And yet, I mean, that's wonderful. If you have access to such states, that is a gift. But they are meant to be used to discern more about reality. So it could be tempting to just sit, okay, I'm achieving the goal of Zen because I can achieve this pleasant meditative state. But then it's like, well, a little bit more. What else? What is going on? What is the nature of this life? Who is sitting there? And for those of us who do not have such ready access, I think of it like this. If, a moment of clarity, of kind of non-dual awareness where your mental map falls away, if you kind of compare it to like there's this dark room and then a light comes on. I mean, a light could come on for a moment and you could be like, you could see a great deal. You can orient yourself in just a moment. If the light came and stayed on, and I don't know, I guess you could sit there and you can investigate and absorb more. But we can get enough to sustain our practice. Just moments of samadhi, moments of that non-dual awareness. So I think, in terms of that sense of like, talking about it, I think it makes sense that, those of us who struggle to calm our minds, or allow our minds to become calm, it's natural that we kind of share that and hope that others have maybe some advice, or they can commiserate with us, or we're expressing our frustration or whatever. But those who have more access, I don't know, you might think of it as like it's not something you have to hide. And I think it's good for us to discuss it in this kind of setting so people know there's different kinds of experiences. Not everybody has anything like our brain. But at the same time, yeah, I mean, I guess it would be a little like, if you knew a friend was really hard up financially and you were going on and on about your amazing overseas trip you just went on. I mean, so you have to be, secretive about it, but on the other hand, sensitive. So I will leave it there. We didn't leave enough time, but there are a few moments for comments and questions.
I'd like to go, but I don't know if there was a person here who wanted to go first.
Is Maria still here? Oh yeah, Maria, did you want to ask a question earlier? Looked like your hand was up.
I think I am the only Maria. No, I didn't want to ask. I
All
didn't want to ask. Thank you.
right. Okay.
Thank you for this talk. if someone were around me who said that, I would want to know, so how did it change your life? What else are you doing with it? I have the impression from my earliest days here that you don't really talk about your experience meditating, for better or worse. And I like that rule, if you want to call it that, I think for that reason. I mean, in addition to wanting to ask the person what they're doing with it, I would go away from the conversation saying, here's the money and I haven't had it yet. I mean, that would be my reaction. He or she, I don't know who asked the question. And all I know is that when I meditate, it's over and I get up, I'm happier. That's all. And I do struggle with, because another thing that I felt was drummed into my head when I got here was the goal of goallessness. So
thank you for bringing that up, because I forgot to add something.
Well, I always approach Zazen as what's going to happen this time. I would feel bad if I said, maybe this time it'll happen. You know, I just.
Jogen said Zazen is not meditation practice. And Kazan said, although we speak of practice, it is not a practice that you can do. This is not the 16-stage practice of the hearers. That means the path of vision or insight that consists of 16 moments of insight into the Four Noble Truths emerging from a meditative process that transforms an ordinary person into a noble one. So our Zen ancestors are saying that is not what Zazen is. So I like to think Zazen, like, it includes what we're talking about. Like, it includes experiences of samadhi and insights, but it is more than that, right? It is a way of being. Denny.
I'm not sure how to put this into words, but I'm just going to go for it. Not too long ago, there was an exercise that you put out there, Domio, after talking about a stream, a place you used to go to, that made you feel calm and happy and part of everything around you and very single pointed. And there were other people who shared experiences like that. And I can't remember what the theme necessarily was, but it made a huge impression on me because, well, the one that I remember most of all, I think it was Stuart, who talked about being in some mountainous area in Oklahoma, which is very unusual. He was there with a geologist and he got lost and walked up on a rock top that was a cliff, walked right up to the edge, and there were five vultures circling. And all of a sudden he became one of those vultures. And I've had experiences like that too. And they, as you were describing this, the samadhi and experiences like this, where all of a sudden you just, yourself just falls away. There's nothing but that moment. And you just become one with whatever is happening. And it's just the most wonderful, expansive, no self experience.
And I don't know where to take it from there, but I've had similar things happen for moments in meditation, but I guess this is just to say, and maybe it works well following on what you just read from Dogen, that it's a way of being. It's not just, and as Jinryu said, it's not just sitting and hoping for a certain result. It's surrendering, it's letting go, and maybe just having a certain amount of faith that whatever happens, it's what you want to do.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just thought I'd share that.
I think of two things from that, and that's I love how Buddhism points us toward those moments, right? Not just like, well, that was cool. You know, felt like it was one of the vultures far up. Like it says that was reality, right?
Yes.
That look close, value those moments, invite those moments, look closely. That is reality, which can happen at any time, right? And then in terms of the zazen, it's like the kind of self-transcendence that we are looking for. Just thought, like my zazen today was, you know, I don't know. We're not supposed to evaluate it, but if you evaluate it in terms of samadhi moments, it was crap. And I was like, I have a little clock by my seat because I'm the teacher, so I'm keeping an eye on things. And I see we have 3 minutes. And I'm kind of like, well, 3 minutes. Like, I'll try to do zazen for 3 minutes, right? Like, and just, you know, remembering the intention. But, you know, when I follow my own advice, right, and I expand my awareness to include the fact that I just wasted 50 minutes just thinking about stuff, like there's a moment there of like stepping outside of myself, right? Stepping outside of my self-concern. And if I can really just include that without any like, I don't know, self-pity or ambition or frustration or anything like that, right? That's it, right? So I don't know. Zazen is bigger than samadhi. Ruth Ann, did we you have something?
Thanks for the Zen rip on. I thought this is a week in between of continuous practice, deliciously reminding myself, no need to grasp. Thank you so much for this class and
Thank you.
previous
Yeah.
talk.
All right. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, mahabhava, prajna, paramita.
Bye all.
Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you, everyone, for being here.
All right. Well, I hope to see you again for the first time.